This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Ah, Faith and Gorry. It's Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. I don't know how much longer I could keep that up. Oh, golly. We're coming up on St. Patrick's Day, coming up here on March the 17th. And it is a fun day to celebrate. It's just a good reason to have a little green beer, at least some places. Some places don't like to have green beer. But anyhow, I wish everyone who wishes to have a good time to do so. Also, this week, we're going to be having someone who I thought would be interesting to have as a guest because he is from Ireland, and that's Pat Fallon, who is a member of the Intermagic Circle Gold Star, and I'm so happy to have him as a friend and also a guest on this week. Golly, there's so much to talk about here this week. One thing is, the last couple of weeks, we've been running a contest for potentially for someone to win a copy of Maximum Entertainment 2.0 by our friend Ken Weber, who was our guest a few weeks ago, and I will announce the name of the winner on the backside of this podcast, so stay tuned for that. Also, I want to thank everybody who is listening for subscribing to the pod letter, subscribing to the podcast, and for also going out to iTunes to leave a 5-star review. That's greatly appreciated. And also, I want to thank those people who are our friends of the Magic Word, and those are the ones who give us their donations and their time. And I especially want to thank the friends of the Magic Word and also welcome our newest friend of the Magic Word, and that's Mark Deutsch, or Mark Dutch. I always have a problem pronouncing your last name, Mark. I'm sure I'm not the only one. That's Doetsch. Thank you, Mark, very much for being a friend of the Magic Word. Thank you very much for pledging your support using Patreon.com. And I suggest that any of the rest of you would be interested in becoming a member of the Friends of the Magic Word. There are different levels that you can join. And as such, you will have different levels of which you will receive some pretty cool perks along the way. Then also, just go to themagicwordpodcast.com and click on the tab that says Become a Friend of the Magic Word. You can watch a little video tell you why it is that we so desperately really need your support. But I appreciate each and every one of you who have had the financial ability to assist us and keep us going for a lot longer into the future. That's really great, and I appreciate that. This week's episode is also brought to you by the Wonder Bash that is going to be happening in Grand Rapids, Michigan on April the 18th through the 20th. We will be talking with Trino, who is one of the organizers of the Wonder Bash, later in the program, and you can hear more about that. And for a more extensive view on what all is happening, please go to the convention guide on the Magic Word podcast to listen to that short episode or a little short podcast or audio recording, if you will, that will tell you more about what's coming up on that. Wow, as I said, a lot of stuff that's happened here this week, and I'm very excited to present this week's guest, Mr. Pat Fallon. Pat, as I said, has been a longtime friend of mine, and he's a member of the Intermagic Circle, Gold Star. He's been a performer for a long number of years, touring throughout not only Ireland, but then throughout the UK, and we have just a marvelous chat. We happened to get together when we were in Blackpool just recently at the Blackpool Magic Convention, and we chatted for a little bit there and decided to get together at a later time because it was so busy I really couldn't sit down for an hour to chat with him. So we recorded this via Zoom. Then once we got back to our respective homes, he in Dublin and I back in Georgetown, Texas, which is here just north of Austin, Texas. Anyhow, I know that you're going to enjoy this as you hear a little bit about my favorite leprechaun, someone who is a lecturer, a performer, a creator, and just an all-around great guy, and I have nothing but the greatest respect for this gentleman, and I know that you're going to enjoy our chat. So please welcome my guest this week from Dublin, Ireland, Mr. Pat Fallon, here on the Magic Word. I have with me now a gentleman that
Well, how can I explain this? I really haven't. I've had so many people from all over the world in different countries, but this is one country that I have not had a guest from in the past. It's Ireland, the country of Ireland, and I have not had a guest from there in the past. And I was so excited because he's not just a guest. He is a good friend of someone that I've known for 20, 30, 40 years. Seems like quite a while. It's been a while since we first met and maintained a good relationship. Relationship throughout. And he is not only just a performer, he is a lecturer, an author, he is a creator, and a both close-up and stage, and does strolling magic, does some wonderful stuff, as well as the stage shows he was doing from coast to coast all around Ireland and elsewhere then as well, doing corporate work and different openings for different brands and things like that, in addition to birthday parties on up or down, whichever way you consider birthday party. Anyhow, a lot of there are not a lot of magicians necessarily in Ireland, and I find that kind of interesting when you look at the nearby England, where there are just lots and lots of magicians. And we had just recently run into each other again and renewed our friendship when we were at Blackpool Convention earlier this year. He is one of, or is not one of, he is the only member of the Intermagic Circle with Gold Star in who resides in Ireland, actually. Enough of me telling you about him. Here he is right now, my buddy. Hey, Pat. Pat Fallon, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. After that introduction, I can't wait to meet myself. You see how good I really am. Yeah. One small correction. I was the only Inner Magic Circle with Gold Star in Ireland until my good friend Quentin Reynolds decided to move back from England. So I have to share that honor with him now.
When are you going to boot him out?
Well, we got rid of him for 20 years, and unfortunately, we had to bring him back.
He is a very clever lad. I love that guy.
Absolutely. Yeah. Good friend, has been for most of my magical career.
I'd probably say, for those of you who may not know who Quentin Reynolds is, that if you will go to Facebook and request a friend, if not, just follow him, because the things he posts are very funny. He has some really good lines. He's a great comedian, good magician. I see him each year also at the 4F convention. Wonderful lad. I like him a lot, too. Being in Ireland and St. Patrick's Day is coming up soon. Is St. Patrick's Day something that is a big celebration in Ireland, or is it more in the U.S.?
No, it's a big celebration in Ireland. Most of towns have their own parades and things like that. The county councils, government departments would often run festival days and so on like that. It varies over the years. Sometimes they have a lot of entertainment. Other times it's just more the parade is the big thing, and they spend a lot of money on it and so on. But I've worked a lot of St. Patrick's festivals, which used to be a one day, and now it's pretty much 3 or 4 days, you know.
That's what I was going to ask you, if it's kind of an extended more than just the one day. So it is longer.
Yeah, it has. They kind of take in, depending on what day of the week it falls on, they take in the weekend before or the weekend after.
And when you're talking about performing at the festivals, are you doing strolling type of street magic, or are you doing a stand-up kind of a thing?
It would just depend on what they booked you for. Sometimes you would do 4 shows in the afternoon. I have my own little setup, a little stage that I bring, and my PA, and outdoor PA, and set up and do stand-up shows. Mm-hmm. I don't busk. It's a different. It's like you have a set show, so which is the same as buskers have a set show,
right?
But you're looking for money. You're being paid to be there, and I've always felt it was important that people knew that. You know, it was free entertainment, that they didn't have to put their hand in their pocket when you were finished.
Right.
Because, again, you don't want to be interfering with the buskers who are earning their living from.
You have been working for a long time, since like the 80s throughout Ireland. And when I said there are not a lot of magicians there, I asked you some years ago, I was wanting to do a lecture tour in Ireland. You said there are only like 2 clubs, like in the whole country.
Yeah, that's it. There is one in Belfast, north of the country, which is sort of part of Britain still, and one in Dublin. Now, there have been a few others started up in Cork and in Limerick, but they didn't last, unfortunately. In fact, the guys in Limerick, who I think you probably met when you were over, Paddy Ward and Vincent Finucane, way back in that time, had a very good... Yeah, they had a very strong club for a few years and ran some great conventions. had the likes of Paul Daniels and Harry Blackstone and the Morettis, you know. I mean, they really did run great conventions, but they just ran out of steam and membership dropped off and then it disappeared completely, really.
Was it because, well, like you talked about Quentin having moved away and then come back, is it could that some people had left or just they don't have a program for teaching new, encouraging new young people or what?
Well, I think this is sort of typical of the world over at the moment, that young magicians don't want to belong to magic societies. They want to just go and do their own thing. And, you know, that is a problem if you can't encourage them to come in. I mean, we know from past experience that being a member of a magic society and meeting up with fellow magicians is good for you, and you grow and you learn from them and they learn from you. It's a wonderful thing. But they don't seem to see that. They'd rather sit and watch YouTube videos and not get involved with real people.
Now, when you were over for Blackpool, did you see many young magicians from Ireland there?
Yeah, there were quite a few. And again, I mean, some of them they would come to the magic societies, but a lot of them just don't bother. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what it is, whether they're afraid to stand up and perform in front of other magicians, whether they feel that, you know, they're beyond, you know, going to a magic society. I mean, people have said, oh, I'm far too advanced for that. Whatever they mean by that, I have no idea. But
Well, my thought, and I don't have any analytical data to back this up, but I have always thought that it's just people who are younger and of the digital age can get their fix of being socializing basically by going into social media, and they can talk with people like we are now on over Zoom, or that we can be a part of some sort of a forum or a group. And if we want to buy a trick, we can see it performed by the dealer and then buy it directly that way or something. So they don't need to have that physical interaction. It's just that there's a different way of interacting today than it was just even 10 years ago.
Well, indeed. And the funny thing is that the one good thing that came out of COVID, I suppose, was we started to talk to each other on Zoom, and we still have a Friday meeting whenever we're available with some lovely people who come on, and we have conversations just for an hour on a Friday, which is something we'd never done before. But they're from Scotland and England and Ireland, of course, and sometimes even further afield. And it's just a great, you know, chat about magic and talk magic. So we can have that social interaction on the internet, but we also have the social interaction at a magic meeting or a magic convention, which is so important.
That's true. But again, I think there's nothing like physical interaction. I mean, you could have interaction as we are now, again, digitally or over a telephone or whatever, but still, I think there's nothing like actually, you know, sitting across the table at a pub or someplace, you know, with someone or having a cup of coffee or something to exchange ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. It's sad to say that there are some members in the Magic Society that I attend in Dublin that I have never actually seen perform a trick. And they're apparently quite competent and good magicians, but they just don't perform in front of other magicians. Whether this is a nervous situation or whether it's... you know, I really don't know. And I've always felt that if you can perform in front of other magicians, then you can perform in front of anybody.
That's pretty much what I believed also. And I have seen some people who are professionals who have frozen up in front of magicians, which is amazing. I mean, they always portray the confidence whenever I've seen them perform before a non-magician group, but then when they've gotten in front of magicians, it's kind of like a little bit more nervous just because they're judging them or something. So I think there's something to that, Pat. You might have an idea there, you know, something.
Yeah. From my own personal point of view, there's only two things that make me nervous. One is live television, because you just never know what's going to happen. And the second thing is probably performing at magic conventions where you are performing to your peers and you just don't want anything to go wrong. Especially if you're doing something with manipulation and things like that, which is a bit dodgy at the best of times.
That's right.
I think as a stand-up comedy magician, if you happen to run aground somewhere, you talk your way out of it.
Right. But if you've got a silent act and you're working to music and one of the balls drops from your hands or the cards, you know, don't appear at the right time or the dove doesn't come out, it's a problem.
I think one of my scariest moments, I performed at Blackpool on a few occasions. And the last time I performed on the stage show, I didn't realize that I knew they were there, but it never crossed my mind. They had two giant screens either side of the stage. Mm-hmm. So even the people in the gods could actually see up close what you were doing. And I couldn't wait till Bob Hamilton sent me the video so I could have a look at it to see, did I really, you know, flash or, you know, do something that didn't look good.
Right.
And finally I could breathe a sigh of relief. It was fine. And, but it was just when I saw the screens when I walked into the theater the next night, I thought, oh my God, you know, what was I like?
That can be intimidating. Yeah. When you think, okay, I'm larger than life. And I remember years ago, whenever we had gone to a higher resolution of movies and television. And I remember some of the actors and actresses in Hollywood were talking about how that on the big screen, you can now see the pores of their skin. I mean, not just the makeup and what kind of makeup job they have, but you could actually, I mean, it was so tight and so clear, you know.
Indeed. So. Yeah, I can see that.
Well, you raised this a point there a moment ago when you were talking about working on television and particularly live television where something could go wrong. What do you do to tip the odds in your favor when you are performing on television?
I always do stuff that I really know well, and that I can, if there's a problem, I have an out already, you know. It's mm-hmm. It doesn't tend to happen, I have to say, because as I said, I'm working with material that I'm very well used to performing, and there's nothing much can phase you on it.
Right.
I think, you know, young magicians sometimes on talent shows are trying to fool everybody, and particularly fool magicians, and they're working with material that's untried and untested. Mm-hmm. This happens a lot in competitions as well. They think that, I mean, when I did my first competition, I thought, well, I'm going to do something to fool the magicians. But how foolish was I to think that, you know? And I learned my lesson very quickly, you know. Mm-hmm. Do something. It's not about fooling them. It's about entertaining them.
That's very true. And that's one of the things also from what I understand on Penn & Teller Fool Us over here, and they had that in the UK for a while there as well. They say that you shouldn't be going on the show thinking that I'm really going to fool these guys. You should be looking at it as an opportunity to feature or showcase a trick and yourself and your personality to the world who is watching this, actually, to see where you can take it from there. So it's not something, it's not for the trophy or getting to go to Las Vegas and performing on their stage, but it's really more for having that video opportunity.
Yeah, and there's nothing like live television for good promotional material. Mm-hmm. And it still stands to you. I mean, it's not quite as what would you call it, important as it was years ago. I mean, appearing on TV years ago was just such a big deal. But now with so many, you know, talent shows and opportunities for people, it's not quite the same thing. Back in the day when there was only BBC television, if you appeared on TV at night, you know, everybody in the country saw you. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, there's so many channels that you could be on and nobody even knows you're there.
That's true. Well, same thing in the U.S. It used to be that Johnny Carson and The Tonight Show was something that was important, so much so that if you were on the show that night, the next day, your phone would be ringing off the hook with job opportunities. But now there are so many other talk shows and everything else to choose from, and I'm sure it's the same then there as well. You don't have a lot of broadcast studios. I mean, there is the BBC, of course, BBC 1, 2, 3, 4, I guess. But is there an Irish channel as well?
Oh yeah. I mean, we have Virgin Media have 3 or 4 different stations or channels, if you like, and RTE have 2, and then there's 1 in Irish, and then in the north of Ireland we have the BBC and ITV, because, you know, they're separate from the BBC, ITV in the UK. I mean, they show a lot of the same programs, but they're regionalized, I suppose. So we're quite fortunate now. There are a lot of television stations. Unfortunately, there are not the programs to perform on anymore.
I mean, why do you think that is? Because they've gone more to like reality type shows over there, like we do here, or what?
Yeah, it is reality TV. And there's, you know, 1 or 2 chat shows. Breakfast TV, I suppose, is the most, the best vehicle now for promoting a show if you want to do something like that.
Because, what is, I'm sorry, you said, what is the best way?
Breakfast television.
Breakfast television, okay.
Yeah, and because they have, you know, 4 or 5 hours a day to fill, and you know, 5-6 days a week. So there is a bit of space there. But regards to you know, shows where you would have interviews and performances, they come very few and far between now.
Was there a point in your career, Pat, in which you were thinking about, or perhaps may have been contacted and considered to be on a show or to be a regular type of character or something?
Yeah, I did. Disney Club was a show for sort of children, I suppose. Not so much the younger ones, but they ran it on a Saturday morning. And I became the wizard, so performed every week, one or two effects. And that ran for about 18 months or 2 years. And then it moved on to something else, you know, but that was it. A lot of the children's TV shows for the teenagers, I did quite a few of those over the years, which was
always. Was that in Dublin or Belfast? Or did you have.
Yeah, in Dublin. Yeah, okay. I did some BBC as well, various chat shows and things like that.
When you were on the chat show, did they contact you because they were looking for something different, or were you trying to sell? I know that you have been performing, doing big stage shows, and also, or were you trying to promote your shows?
Yeah, no, they would contact you about either. I didn't do many interviews, but just performances.
I see.
Which was, you know, the best thing. You might get a little bit of it, you know, before or after your performance, a few words, but I've never done in-depth interviews, really. It's not something that I've ever been asked to do, except by somebody called Scott Wells. I don't know if you know him.
So you're saying that after Graham Norton sees this, he's going to say, I want to have Pat Fallon on my show.
Yes, indeed.
Now, when you were doing some stage shows, I remember asking you this several years ago, that you and Tanya, or you worked with Tanya for how many years?
16 years almost.
Yeah. 16 years. And you were doing a large stage show, because you were talking about Paul Daniels and Blackstone and others, you know, who were coming in. Were those people who shows you, I wouldn't say emulated, but you liked the stage better than the close-up at the time?
Yes, indeed. I mean, I would open with my Dove act and then go into stand-up comedy, audience participation type magic with illusions. And, you know, we were doing the sub-trunk and the zigzag sword cabinet, those kind of illusions interspersed between, you know, the other audience participation. I had a lovely Jack Hughes guillotine, which was quite scary, which was always good fun. So what I would do is, if I was touring with another act, I would do probably 45 to 50 minutes, which would be the first half of the show. And doing my own show, then I would extend it by, you know, putting in the hydrostatic glass, the card sword, and you know, that extra material to bring it out to, you know, 2 40-minute slots each side of an interval. So that was the
and as far as the theaters where you're working, there are just a few theaters. I mean, it seems like over in England, there are a lot of theaters, you know, from north to south and, of course, throughout London. But are there many theaters or venues for you to perform your act in Ireland?
Yeah, I mean, most of the cities all have theaters in this bigger towns, but we used to do what we always called the fit-up show, where you came in, put up your own backdrops, and worked in hotel rooms that would be set out in theatre style.
Oh, I see.
So pretty much the same thing. And that was so that's how you got the extra venue, because if you were just depending on theatres, unless you were going to do a week in each one, which was a bit optimistic to try and do that, mostly one night, maybe two at most. Some of the bigger acts I toured with, you could do 3 or 4 weeks in a theatre, which was great. You always loved to move in, bring in all the props, and not have to strike them every night head off.
Right.
But I can assure you that by the end of the 3 weeks or a month, you were
ready to go.
Chomping at the bit to get back on the road again. We're never happy, are we?
Yeah, that's right. Never happy. Yeah. I want this. I want you to get that. It's like, no, I really don't want that. I want this. No, I don't want that. Yeah. Never happy. Exactly right.
Yeah.
Did you ever work cruise ships as well?
No. I'm a very bad sailor. And
you don't like the water?
No. I travel across on the ferry from Ireland to England because I have to take the van and the gear and all the rest of it. But I'm not a good sailor. That's about my limit, you know, 2 hours on that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a land lover.
I understand. And what about the Fringe Festival? Do they, have you ever performed over in Edinburgh?
There are fringe festivals, but I don't tend to ordinary festivals and arts festivals I do.
Mm-hmm.
Which a few years ago, it was quite bizarre because I remember having, we were after doing two nights in a theatre and the theatre manager said, you know, we're having an arts festival soon. Your show would be very good for that. You should contact the arts officer, which I did. And the young lady on the phone says, you do what? I said, I'm a magician. I said, oh, dear. I don't think that's very artistic. No, dear. And she put the phone down, you know.
Wow.
And it took a long time for the art people in the world to accept that magic is an art in its own form. Mm-hmm. Although we're still kind of lumped in with circus. You know, magic and circus is kind of where it is. And I would like to see it someday being recognized as its own particular type of entertainment and an art form.
That's true. It's not considered a performance art in the same level like as ballet or the symphony or some other kinds of or opera in acting. That's true. Dal Sanders over here had gone, he had some help in the Congress and actually had pushed through a provision or and wasn't an amendment, but it was, I guess, a citation that basically says that the U.S. now does recognize magic as being an art form. In fact, he had received a special award of merit from the Academy of Magical Arts, Magic Castle, in recognition for his work on getting that accomplished, because it not only is something that magicians can point to say, when people like that would say to you, I'm sorry, dear, this is not a really art, and then you say, well, the Congress says that it is, but then second of all, that you can get government grants because it's now considered an art form. Mm-hmm. So that's something perhaps that you might consider in Ireland as well, but that's kind of a long road to try to get that accomplished.
It is. What did happen again, you know, COVID is responsible for this, that the government put a little pressure on the Arts Council to fund people outside of the normal realm. To help them during the, you know, the days of non-earning. And so that opened the door, really, to funding being made available to magicians and people of, you know, that line of work, mime artists and things like that. So it is happening. It's just going to be, as you say, a slow process. And I may not be around to see it, but I'll do my best while I can.
Well, there was a similar thing here during COVID. The government had put into place for gig workers, those who are dependent upon each job to make their paycheck, you know, to pay for things. And as a result, that gig workers were given a stipend then as well. So it sounds like that Ireland had done a similar kind of a thing.
Yeah, they did, which is very grateful. What is really bizarre, I remember sitting on the port of Holyhead on the way back from doing some touring in the UK, and life was really good. And Tanya and I were just sitting there talking about the future. And I switched on the radio, and there was an announcement to say that there had been an outbreak of foot and mouth disease in the UK. And what happens in the UK naturally becomes major problems for Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And the country shut down pretty much. And we came home to an empty diary and
wow.
Everything, because, you know, there was a whole problem about moving, transporting anything, you know, to try and keep foot and mouth out of Ireland.
I remember, foot and mouth is when you, different thing. We call it hoof and mouth. I guess that was the cow, cow thing. And they had to put down a lot of cattle.
Yeah. And, you know, it's a scary business. And I mean, we understood why they had to lock down the country, but all corporate events stopped. And, you know, there was no, very difficult to travel between Ireland and England and anything like that. And and COVID was the same sort of thing. It suddenly came at you out of the blue. And you look at an empty diary and wonder, where am I going from here?
So many magicians had experienced the same thing, obviously, around the world. I mean, in which they had contracts for cruise ships and corporate events and everything, and quite literally within 24 hours or 48 hours, they all got canceled.
Yeah, nothing left. But we survived, and this is the thing, we always seem to survive, which is testament to what we do, I suppose.
That's a good point. And going back and talking about some of the tours, you were saying that you do or had done some over in England as well, and just kind of take the ferry over. Do you find a difference in the audiences between the two countries, or are they both the same as far as their enjoyment of magic?
Pretty much the same. There's not a huge difference. And the thing would be probably that if I was working with another act, who would be Irish, it would bring a lot of the expats to the show. Mm-hmm. So it was a bit like, you know, as well as the people from the UK, of course, but it was almost like performing in Ireland. Magic conventions, well, there's magicians and magicians the world over, and it was never any real difference with that. Performing in magic conventions are the same.
And when you were talking about working in some of the hotels and the banquet rooms that you set up to be like a theater, I'm assuming that probably would then seat, what, a couple hundred people as opposed to 1,000 in a larger theater?
Well, the biggest one we used to do was up in Donegal, and it was 850 people. Mm-hmm. And, so it was quite a big, but most of them would be somewhere between 400 and 500.
Mm-hmm.
I've worked with a very good promoter in Ireland here, Tom Kelly, who's been around for more years than anybody cares to remember. But he really understands show business and how to put bums on seats, you know.
Right.
He's a really good guy. There's quite a few of them. We never had what you'd call agents here, like the UK and I suppose in the States, where you had an agent who worked on your behalf.
Right.
We have corporate entertainment agents who run corporate events and business, and they just ring you when they want a magician or an act or whatever they want like that. I've never actually had a manager of my own or an agent of mine. You do your own work.
I was going to ask about that a little bit, because we have two different types over here then as well. One of which would be the agent, as you're talking about, someone who's working for you and is getting a percent of what you're making. And so they're working on your behalf because they're going to be asking for as much as they can because of that percentage they're going to be getting.
Yeah.
And your contractual obligation you have with the agent, as opposed to someone that I would call a party planner, who is kind of just looking at a myriad of different variety acts of whether they're going to be jugglers or magicians or DJ or band or whatever it's going to be, let's say for a wedding or something like that. And they're just looking for the cheapest person because they're not getting a percent. They're getting a fee, and they're telling you, here's what we can pay you. And you just either say yes or no, and they may be ending up getting more than 100% than what you're being paid.
Yeah.
And so party planners are ways of getting work. You know, I'm always telling people if they're going to be working with one, that they should be wary to make sure they know what percent actually they're getting and who they're working with and how reliable that they are, because sometimes they might even double book somebody.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. I suppose the people, the agents here, you wouldn't have a sole agent. They were agents in the real sense of the word, but they, you know, you could work for 6 or 7 of these different agents on sure. that kind of basis.
Well, and, same here, because you don't have a contract with them.
No. And it worked well. And, you know, for me, I was very happy with the way it went. The big problem was that when these agents got older and decided they'd had enough, and again, COVID was responsible for this, they just decided, look, enough is enough. And I lost some of my really good agents that I worked for.
Mm-hmm.
They just packed it in. And a lot
closed shop and never reopened.
No. But those who have taken their place don't have the same experience. They're more like what you just mentioned there, the party planners. And they're, you know, they start looking at things like age and saying, oh, well, he's too old for this. You know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as you and I know, most magicians, you're never too old to be a magician, as long
That's
as you
right.
can still stand up and walk and, you know, count as mentors, you're okay. But you can't tell some 25-year-old, you know, who's just started in the business. He just looks at you and makes a decision that you're not right for him. So that's about it.
It's all you can do. You're right.
we're going to take a quick moment here to help pay the bills as we hear from our sponsor this week, Wonder Bash, coming up in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Wonder Bash in Grand Rapids, Michigan is coming up on April the 18th through the 20th. And I have with me right now Trino, who is one of the organizers. Hey, man, how you doing?
Hey, Scott. I'm good. How are you?
Fantastic, sir. I know you've got a lot of great talent lined up and things for them to do as far as the shows and lectures. Let's kind of quickly recap. Who are some of the top talent you got coming in?
That's right. We got Taylor Hughes. Taylor's coming in. He's doing the full Saturday evening show on the Feel Good Magic Tour. So Taylor's going to come perform, do the whole show and lecture. We got Joe Devlin, the Matador of Magic, on Friday night for the Amaze and Amuse Takeover show. That's the monthly show I do here in Grand Rapids. We got a Wonder Bash takeover for the month of April with Joe Devlin, emceed by Giancarlo Bernini. And we also have Bryn Cummings, who was just seen on America's Got Talent this last season. She'll be on that show as well. And then Saturday morning for a matinee show, we have Tim Hanning is coming to do the full Pro Kids show. So you get to see one of the top family and kids entertainers in the entire country do his show in front of real people, which I'm very excited to see as well. We also have Rick Merrill, FISM World Champ and Grand Rapids local, that's going to be there and hosting a very special evening event. And then we have Felice Ling and John Sterk, who are coming, and they'll be performing in a parlor show and then talking about street performing and how to get into street performing as well.
So there are going to be five lectures then as well over the period of time, featuring some of those people as well, and three full stage shows.
That's right. And the parlor show on top of that.
And then something that's going to be quite unique will be the bedtime stories. Tell me something about that.
That's right. Bedtime stories is Friday night after the evening show back at the hotel. It's 18 and up or with a guardian. Pajamas are recommended. We've served milk and cookies before. We'll see what happens this year. The first year we did this, we had Dan Sperry, who told us some crazy stories about traveling and touring and just different old showbiz stuff that I can't even repeat it. But that'll be Friday night. And I'm hoping, fingers crossed, I believe Rick Merrill is going to be hosting bedtime stories, which
That's cool.
I can't wait for.
And you had said to me beforehand that this is usually attended by less than 100 people or so, which makes this really an intimate convention and an opportunity that you can sit down and talk with these people really one-on-one and get some insight.
That's right. Rather than hearing somebody lecture, watching them perform, and they go back to their hotel room and you never see them the rest of the convention, all of these performers are accessible and you can ask them questions and you can actually sit down and there's downtime during the day to go grab a sandwich or something and actually pick the brain of some of these amazing performers.
Pretty cool. And so for people who want to go and get more information and register for the convention, what is the website?
Go to morethantricks.com.
There you are. Trino, thanks very much. Wonder Thank Bash, April 18th through 20th, morethantricks.com.
And now back to the rest of our conversation with our guest from Dublin, Ireland, Mr. Pat Fallon.
Yeah. In your experience and where you have performed both in the UK and in England and elsewhere around the world, has there been a particular show or something that you have done or seen that stands out in your mind? It's like, man, this was just a great show.
That I did myself?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there were a few nights, I suppose, when you've really come, you know, buzzing. I'm just trying to think now, particularly. I remember getting my first standing ovation, which, funny enough, wasn't in a theater. It was actually in a fit-up show. And you had to walk up the middle of the room to get on the stage, and you had to walk down the middle of the room when you were finished. And it was up in the north of Ireland. I can't remember exactly where it was. So we finished the act, took our bow, gathered up our few little bits and pieces that, you know, to walk away. And the audience all stood up and applauded as we walked down along. And I was in a state of shock. And now we'd gone really well, but it was just suddenly it had never happened before.
You're a rock star.
Yeah. And because as soon as we'd vacated the stage, then the crew would come in and strike all the bits and pieces and stuff. But I'm trying to think. I've had a few really, just trying to pick one out in particular, doesn't seem to jump up at the moment.
Another thing is, are the weddings similar, I should say, the wedding opportunities and the wedding scene for magicians similar in Ireland as they are in England?
Yeah, they would be the same. A lot of close-up magic, either drinks, receptions, or during dinner. Mm-hmm. And after-dinner shows, which I've been doing quite a few in recent years. Well, all the time, but in recent years, more so than anything else, I suppose. The only problem there sometimes is that they have to turn the room around after dinner, which mm-hmm. causes a bit of a gap. And sometimes people book you and say, oh, you'll be ideal when they're turning the room around. And you have to explain, well, no, that doesn't work. You have to wait till the room is turned around.
Right.
And then we do the show. And but they understand. Yeah, and wedding shows are very good. They're very enjoyable.
And usually those are booked pretty far in advance, as I understand, too.
They would be, yeah. Again, going back to the COVID situation, the longest I ever had a wedding in my diary was 6 years. Because it was booked pre-COVID
yeah.
for a number of years, and then COVID came, and then it was pre-booked again then for another couple of years. So it was almost 6 years from the day of booking.
You win on that story, because I had a similar one, but mine wasn't 6 years. Mine was booked pre-COVID also. It was supposed to be happening, like, I think in March of 2020, when we also went in lockdown. And then they said, okay, we're going to have it 6 months later, you know, and then a year later. And then finally said, well, we'll let you know. And finally got around to it, but it was, I think, in 23. So it was only about 3 years. But yours was 6 years, so you win.
6 years, yeah. And, yeah, it was just one of those weird things. And funny enough, a couple of weddings that I'd booked for didn't happen after COVID, which was rather embarrassing for some poor, unfortunate bride-to-be writing to say, dear Mr. Fallon, I'm very sorry to say that the wedding is no longer going ahead. And
wow.
The only thing you reply and say, well, isn't it better you found out now rather than 6 months' time? So it was, a bit peculiar.
What do you do in a case like that as far as your deposit, or do you ask for a deposit in your contract?
I would do, yeah. And in those circumstances, I would return the deposit, to be honest.
Okay. Yeah, because it's something that's like, they're not going to have it, and there are reasons for that, and it wouldn't be right for you to keep it.
No, and I mean, I don't know whether the hotels and people like that they've been working with would do the same thing, but I just, you know, it's, I just think it's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, as far as weddings go also, from what I understand, that sometimes weddings go long all day long. They'll have a breakfast and a dinner. Mm. Is that right? And so you kind of might work the same wedding twice in the same day.
Yeah. No, not to my experience. It's the following day.
Following
they
day,
have
okay.
Another event, lunchtime, and before everybody breaks up and goes home. And mm-hmm. But you would tend to do either the wedding or the day after, but not both.
Okay. Well, okay, similar here, in which there'll be like a wedding party the night before, a wedding banquet or dinner that's going to be for the immediate family and the bridesmaids and the groomsmen and everybody. And so there might be something there to perform for on the evening before, and then the wedding usually the next day. And I assume the weddings are during the daytime and never in the evenings?
Usually during the afternoon. Weddings tend to be around 3 p.m. in the mm-hmm. afternoon. And, mm-hmm. You know, dinner then is around about 5:30. So you have this drinks reception, you know, for 2 hours between that. I've often worked drinks reception and, you know, dinner as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you do different sort of material for both. Or you would do drinks reception and after dinner show. It depends on what they actually want. Weddings are good fun. I enjoy them. They usually, because everybody seems to be happy at a wedding.
Exactly. Yeah. And the big advantage, obviously, of a magician is the way that you can be a conversation starter and an icebreaker to try to get different groups together who may not otherwise know each other.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things I make sure I do is that normally the bride and groom are so busy between photographs and, you know, meeting people like that, is that when the guests all go into dinner, I presume it's the same in the States, they usually sit down and have a drink themselves and, you know, just to compose themselves. And I would always tell them that I would come and entertain them for a few moments. And if they want to bring the rest of the bridal party, like the bridesmaids and the grooms, they're all been out doing photographs. They don't get to see anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had some wonderful sessions. In fact, on a few occasions, you have to kind of stand up and say, listen, I think it's time you went into dinner, you know, because they get into the fun of it. And it becomes more like a little stand-up show, because you could have anything from 12 to 14 people between parents and the various
families.
Families and stuff.
So is that in a separate room? That's not going to be in the dining room with the rest of the people?
No, that would be in a separate room, yeah.
Okay.
It depends on the wedding. I mean, sometimes all the bridesmaids and the, you know, the best men go in to the dining room and they sit and wait with all the other guests while the bride and groom sort of straighten themselves up and have a quiet moment together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just did one a couple of weeks ago in which it took a while for them to have the photos taken. And then when they came out, the bride and groom really just kind of socialized as far as walking from table to table and thanking everybody for coming. And it took another 15 minutes for them to sit. There was always a head table. It was over there by the DJ where they would sit. And so that's whenever, if I can get a moment to go over and do something then for them before they do the rest of the whatever they're going to be doing, you know, tossing the bouquet and et cetera, and the first dance and whatever. So it's hard to try to figure out the exact time to get in.
Yeah. You know? I have found that sort of gap between when the guests have been sent off and they have their few moments. But I would always prearrange it with them. I wouldn't suddenly bounce into them and say, oh, by the way, I'm going
to do it. That's a good idea.
You know, they might go, well, we want 5 minutes on our own. Thank you very much. Goodbye, you know.
Right. It's kind of like you've already done what you were supposed to do. You entertained our guests and we'll see you.
Yeah, yeah. And the one thing that has changed in recent years as well, I mean, you would finish entertaining it and you'd be looking for the best man to get the balance of the money or whatever, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas nowadays it's all usually done online beforehand, you know. And,
right.
Sorted. So when you are finished, you can just hightail it out of town, you know.
Yep. You don't have to worry about that. I do like to go over to obviously say goodbye and thank whoever the host was for booking me, maybe the father, the bride, or whomever had booked you for that then. I mentioned up at the top of this episode then as well that you were a creator and author as well, that you have created some different kinds of things. And when you lecture, what is in your lecture? What do you talk about?
Mostly what I talk about is my approach to magic, because believe it or believe it not, I am very unskilled as a magician. I mean, the most skillful card thing I do is an Emsley count. I like to find simplistic ways of doing magic, and I pass them on. I know there are a lot of magicians who are not skilled, mm-hmm. and they just feel they have no place in magic because they watch the people doing all these wonderful, skillful things. And I've made a very good living out of magic. And I've always started my lectures with saying I've been a professional magician now for almost 40 years. And I've never done a difficult trick yet. And I mean, that's basically it. I find easier ways to do things.
You're the Carol Fox of Ireland, it sounds like.
Yeah, well, it's sort of, yeah. And I love to find, there's a big difference between story magic and magic with a story. I don't actually like story magic where it's like, you know, oh, this white handkerchief is the, you know, the princess and this is something else. Magic with a story is what I enjoy because people buy into it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's basically what I talk about in lectures. Easiest way to do a magic effect and how to sell it with a story or a good pattern, lines to go with it, you know. And that's basically what I lecture on.
How do you go about scripting? What is your secret to writing a good script for
Something that Billy McComb told me many years ago. He said, if you have a prop and you don't know what to do with it, you put it next to your bed so you see it last thing at night and first thing in the morning. And it seems to, I don't know what it is, but you suddenly, you know, see what's happening. I'll give you an example so we know what we're talking about here. Tricky bottles are, it comes with various different names. I could never understand how to get into this. For ages it sat there. And then one particular day, it suddenly dawned on me that if the bottles came from Australia, Now, this is a kind of a regional thing here because Australia is directly under Ireland.
Okay.
That the bottles came from Australia, they would turn over. So that was the basis for the script.
Right.
That the bottles came from Australia. They behave in the most unusual way.
Topsy-turvy. Yeah.
Topsy-turvy. Yeah. And that was how I got into the plot of it. So, you know, they're the sort of things, finding a reason, a justification for why you're doing a certain trick. You know, there's other examples. It's like the pom-pom stick, which a lot of people hate. And the first time I saw it, I actually hated it. And much as I loved Ali Bongo, I never liked his. It was just too repetitive of the green pom-pom, the yellow pom-pom, the pom-pom. It just went on and on and on.
Yes.
And I wrote a different script. But that came from Hank Moorhouse. And the story attached to that was that I was watching Hank's lecture at a convention, an IBM convention in England. And I really enjoyed it. And he said, I'm just going to finish up now. And he picked up the pom-pom stick. And I hated it so much. I was halfway out of my chair. And he said, this is a do-nothing machine because it does absolutely nothing. And I sat back down again. And
he hooked you.
Presentation,
yeah.
And went home then and wrote a slightly different script, but based on the same premise. And it served me very well ever since. Funny, Michael Amar was working on a convention I worked on last year up in Newcastle. And after the show, he said to me, it's a long time since I've seen that, which was the pom-pom stick, you know.
Right.
Because it's fallen out of favor with people. I mean, I think since Hank stopped doing it, nobody else is particularly doing it.
But there are some tricks that are like that. They kind of go in and out of favor. Let's say like the 6-card repeat. You know, yeah. and then it gets a new life whenever somebody has a different variation or take or something on that, you know.
Yeah. Another one of my favorite tricks again. And as I said, I mean, if I go to what I do in my show, there's nothing in it that's difficult. And, you know, linking rings and couldn't restore row. I always did note and wallet in conjunction with the guillotine, electric sawing in half. I love the card sword. I've always loved the card sword. And I use the only child I would use in my show is a boy of about, you know, 12 years of age. And I threatened to run through him with the sword, you know. And, so that's the kind of thing. And
so he tosses the cards up into the air at the wrong time and you have
I never let him toss them all. We used to split it between my assistant, myself, and him. Okay. So we always made sure then that at least two of us were throwing them in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
Because it never happened to me personally, but I know some magicians who people threw them away completely and they were nowhere near it when they lunged forward with the sword. So you don't take chances.
I hadn't thought about that. I haven't seen that happen, but I could certainly see a problem if it's not tossed towards you and you have a blindfold on or whatever, and they throw them behind them or something, and all of a sudden the card appears on your sword. It's like, where did that come from?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you need to control the situation. Have you had something like that that's happened in which it's been out of your control or in a show? It's like, I could have prepared better for that.
Well, the first time that I had a little bit of a hiccup with the card sword was that the person didn't throw the cards. They just pretended to throw.
Okay.
And I was lunging forward, but hadn't, you know, released the button, luckily enough. And so I took half the deck off him then and said, right, well, we both aim for this little spot up there and throw them up and away we were. And he did it a second time, which was just as well.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I mean you learn your lessons, you learn your craft from the mistakes and that you make yourself or you see other people making.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, live and learn. I think that's a very important thing that you said, kind of coming full circle about going to magic conventions and magic club meetings. You get to see other people, and sometimes you see some mistakes, or you might see an idea, as you said, you got from Hank Moorhouse, that you wouldn't have otherwise seen if you hadn't been sitting there at the right place at the right time, that kind of altered the future of one of the tricks that you have as regular now.
Yeah.
So I think it's important that people do get out and socialize physically and get to see, not only experience failure on their own, but see something of someone else's. It's like, oh, I want to make sure I don't do that.
Yeah. Well, I've been very fortunate because, as I said, you know, I've known Quentin most of my magic life, and another gentleman in Ireland called Neville Wiltshire. And Neville was a kids' entertainer, did some close-up as well, Punch and Judy man, very good all-rounder, and has a great eye. And whenever I'd be doing a show, I would always, you know, hope that Neville would turn up some night, and I would listen to, what do you want to do that for? Why don't you do this? Why don't you try that? That doesn't work. And he has a good eye. And this sort of notes after a show are so important. And I think, fortunately, a lot of magicians now don't want to hear notes after a show. They think that they're perfect and don't want to do it. And it's so important that you get your friends to look at it critically and tell you where they think things. You won't always agree with them.
Right.
At least it's food for thought.
You do need to have some outside influence, so another pair of eyes, someone else who has some experience looking at you. I was talking with Ken Weber, and he was just on a recent episode on the podcast here, and talking about his book, Maximum Entertainment 2.0. And one of the things he was talking about is taking notes or giving notes to others. And basically, he said, I don't give advice nor consult nor give notes to someone unless they specifically ask for it. I mean, he could be taking notes during the show, but it may be just for himself that he might think of later when he's consulting for somebody else. But if that person says, do you have any thoughts or anything that I could do better? He said, well, in fact, I do, you know, I have a few things, but he wouldn't offer them saying, hey, I got some ideas for you. Because you're right. People are not going to listen to that if you approach them that way. They're going to look at it as a negative thing, saying, well, no, I want to defend myself because I did it this way because of that. But if they ask for your opinion, then they're going to be more open to it.
Yeah. I did a lecture in Dublin, oh, it must have been 25 years ago. And I did feedback forms, which I handed out. And it wasn't, I didn't want them to say, oh, you were wonderful, you were marvelous. It was, what did you not like about the lecture? What tricks did you not enjoy? Mm-hmm. What kind of material would you rather see? And it was great because, you know, I mean, I gave the free lecture notes for anybody who answered, you know, the questions on it. And I got some great feedback and information from it because I didn't want people just saying, oh, you're great, and we really enjoyed your lecture.
Sure.
You know, so much better to find out what. And I would ask people, you know, when we'd be selling merchandise after the show, and occasionally I'd say to somebody, is there anything you didn't like in the show? You know, after they've told you how much they enjoyed it, and just say, was there anything you didn't particularly like? And it's surprising, you know, what information you gather and makes you rethink certain things.
I really like that. That's a completely different kind of a twist, because typically when I have finished a show and people are complimenting you, then I'll say, what is it you like best about the show? Because my thinking has been that if I start hearing more of the same kinds of things that I like this or that, then it's like, okay, they like that. And the other things I don't hear comments about, that then those will be the things I can change in the show, until finally the kinds of compliments I would get is like, I just liked it all. There's nothing that stood out better than the other. And then ultimately it's like, I just like you. I like your personality. I like the way that you presented that. I mean, that's what we're all like striving for. And that's what I was trying to do. But I like your idea of what is it that you don't like about the show, or what, or the lecture, or whatever.
Yeah. And yeah, it is. I remember, funny enough, an incident with Tanya many years ago. We had this blazing row. I had introduced the Just Chance routine into the show. Mm-hmm. And she hated every bit of it. And we got into this real discussion on the way home. And I was sticking to my guns with it. And the following morning, I said, by the way, I said, you know, you were right. And what I developed from that is an effect called the raffle, which is basically, it's a Just Chance routine, but it's more like you're going to win prizes in a raffle. Mm-hmm. It's not this thing about, oh, am I a really clever magician? You know, I've kept my own money and you've got nothing.
Ah.
And the thing that the argument came about was, she said, you have to get rid of the money element of it first. And so what happens in the raffle is that the spectator has a choice of any of the three of the four prizes, and whichever one she doesn't want is left to me.
Mm-hmm.
And you explained that not necessarily the first prize is the best prize and so on. But whatever one you give, you say, I've never won a raffle. Can I open my prize first? and I open it, and inside is €100 or €200, whatever it is. And you say, well, if that was the fourth prize or the third prize, which it usually is, they give you the one down near the end, can you imagine what you're going to get, you know?
Right.
And the rest of them are gag prizes, you know? You know, there's various things like a heart and lung exerciser, which is just simply a balloon. And, you know, they're very standard sort of gags, but, for, you know, people don't realize what they are.
Yeah.
And you end on a laugh.
You could have a bag of water and say, here, you can make your own ice.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing is that whatever, you always keep the best gag prize to last. And one of my favorites is always, you know, a top of the range dishwasher. You just give them this pot scrub, you know. And so you're ending a just chance routine on a laugh, which had been three laughs, but the last one is always the best. Rather than on, I'm a knight, the clever sod, I've just kept all this money and you got nothing.
Yeah, you're a loser and I'm a winner. Yeah, I like that. I like that way you went.
Yeah, so that was, but that came from an argument between my assistant and myself coming home from a gig, you know. And
so you just got to be open and listening to different ideas that are coming to you.
Yeah, and I mean, lots of other things, you know, she would have suggested and over the years, because as I said to you before, she was not just an assistant. She was very clever in her own right and loved magic and and read a lot and could perform. You know, she would do all the dealer dems with me. She could do any trick that I've ever put out, you know.
Right. Right.
But that's where you do learn from notes. And I've learned from a lot of notes.
Do you keep notes after your show? Do you jot down things?
Yeah. I'm embarrassed, actually. I have the notes. Did my first professional gig 40 years ago on the 12th of February with a couple, two guys called Foster and Allen, who were big country music kind of people in Ireland and all around the world, had a huge following. And I still have the notes from that show, my first ever professional show. And I'm embarrassed when I look what I was doing because I knew very little. I was working professionally before I ever met another magician. Before I ever really saw a magician performing except on TV. And it was Pat Page's Big Book of Magic that really got me, you know, up and running. And I was working material out of that.
Did you get to know Pat pretty well?
I did, yeah. Yeah. And in fact, the first time I met him, I brought my copy of the book along for him to sign. And it was a paperback copy because I'd bought it at a local bookshop. And he looked at it and he threw it across the room and said, I'm not signing that, because he got into so much trouble when it was released as a paperback with the IBM for exposing magic.
Oh, and interesting.
So before the convention ended, he called me over and said, where's your book? I'll sign it for you. And then some years later, I managed to acquire a hardback copy, and he signed that as well. And yeah, Pat became a good friend and came and stayed with me for a while when he was here in Ireland. And he was a great guy. Loved Pat bits.
Taking this discussion in a different direction for a few moments before we close, I want to talk about magic in restaurants. So I understand that in the UK in general, in Ireland, Scotland, and England, that there are not a lot of restaurant magicians, at least not like there are in the US. There's not a tipping convention there as we have here. Is that pretty much true?
It would be. I worked a lot of restaurants over the years, and one in particular, which was Johnny Fox's, which was a spit and sawdust type place with Irish traditional music and a dance show. But the owner always liked magic, and for 20 odd years, except for when I was away touring, and he wouldn't get in anybody else when I was missing. It was just me or nobody. I used to do three nights a week when I could. And my closing trick in my close-up set, and has been for since I began, would be Pat Page's Easy Money.
Sure.
I mean, there's lots of different variations now with the Extreme Burn and so on.
Yeah.
But I still loved the Pat's version, which was the first one I learned. And I would always do it as a closer, because I don't think if you can make money out of bits of paper or magazines, I don't care how many times the car comes back to the top. It just can't top it.
That's true.
The one thing I loved about it is that, I mean, I do it in 50 euro notes now.
Mm-hmm.
And I use 10 of them. So I end up with 10 50 euro notes, which is a fair sizable amount of money.
To be carrying around, sure.
Yeah. But what I wanted to do was discourage tipping, because I was being paid to be there, and I paid an awful lot more money than the poor waitresses and waiters who were there.
Yeah.
And if people wanted to, you know, tip me, I would say, I would prefer you tipped your waiting staff. And the only time you would accept a tip is if there was corporate people in having a dinner, they would normally stick a 50 in your top pocket or, you know,
mm-hmm.
And that was fine. You just accept, because they were going to tip the waiting staff anyway.
Sure.
But what I found by that was the waiting staff then not resent me in any way, and would be very accommodating. And if they came with food when I was working, they would apologize to you, you know, and say, I'm really sorry, you know, and so on.
Right.
You build a good relationship with the staff, which is important, that you're not taking it from them.
Right. Boy, there's a whole direction we could go right there, you know, and talking about restaurants, certainly, and tipping and working with wait staff, because that is a whole different lecture right there.
Indeed, yeah. And you would notice occasionally, but not very often, staff here tend to be quite respectful to entertainers who come in. But, you know, waitresses at banquets, when there's lots of people, would almost push you out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
Because they want to serve.
Yeah.
Because you don't have a relationship with them.
Mm-hmm.
But the easiest way of doing that, as soon as you see somebody coming, you step back and allow them in. And then they realize, oh, as long as he knows we're here, he's not going to, you know, get in the way.
Right.
I did spend a number of years in the catering business. So I learned a lot about, you know, the whole, you know, catering thing. And it's good to have a bit of a background, because then you understand from their point of view.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some magicians think that they're the be-all and end-all, and that the whole world revolves around them, and can't understand why waiting staff don't agree with them.
Yeah, that's true. Well, as we start to wrap up over here, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. So I would like to know, what is it, your philosophy of life? What is it that, I don't mean a magic word like abracadabra, but what is it that would be a phrase or something important to you?
A phrase, when your work speaks for itself, don't interrupt. And it's above my office here on the wall. It reminds me all the time. And, you know, it's something which I think is important that, you know.
Explain that a little bit. I don't quite understand. When your work speaks, don't interrupt.
When your work speaks for itself, don't interrupt. So, when you're out working and you are getting the applause that you hope you're going to get, and people are enjoying themselves, that's all you need to do. That's what your work is. It's speaking for itself. You don't need to be pushing them down and trying to extract more out of them. That's my philosophy anyway.
That makes sense. Yeah, Pat, that's wonderful. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thanks for your time today.
It's been a pleasure. And thank you so much for asking me, because it's been a joy.
And, it has been.
Yeah, and I look forward to seeing you again. Blackpool again, do you think, next year?
It will be. Maybe not next year, because FISM is next year. So I'm going to be going to Turin, Italy, but probably the year after. I mean, I would like to get back again soon. I just really enjoyed that. And next time, I'm going to spend a little bit more time. Maybe we can get together before or after.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, that would be great. Scott, thank you for having me on your show.
You're welcome. Thank you very much. So for the Magic Word podcast, that was Pat Fallon. This is Scotty M. What a delightful chat. Thank you very much. I appreciate the time that you had given me there, Pat, and I'm glad we got a chance to chat personally while we were in Blackpool, England. A lot of fun it was. Well, this has got to be a little bit longer of an episode than what I had intended, so let's begin to wrap this up by giving you some information. I told you on the first part of this podcast that I would tell you on the back end who it is that had won the contest for a copy of Maximum Entertainment 2.0. I want to thank the 100 people who had entered the contest for a chance to win a copy of this book, and I especially want to thank Mr. Ken Weber for offering this wonderful prize.
And the winner of the contest is Charles Morgan. Congratulations, Charles. Good job. And your name was randomly selected from 100 different people who had registered for this contest. And I want to thank each and every one of you who did register. And of course, I'm sorry, but only one name can be drawn. But please watch for future contests. I want to also thank our guest, that's Ken Weber, who was the one who offered this wonderful prize. And also to all the other guests that we've had over the years who offer different prizes as well. So again, if you just subscribe to the Pod Letter, you will be among the first who will know about these contests that come up from time to time. So don't miss an opportunity to register, and perhaps in a future contest, your name might be drawn then as well. Well, I want to close this out, but I want to thank our sponsor again this week, the Wonder Bash, which is going to be coming up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, April 18th through 20th. Be sure to check that out and register today. For more information, go visit their website. And also a reminder that if you cannot pledge your financial support to us, an easy way to help us would be just to go to iTunes or to whatever platform you listen to the podcast and give us a 5-star review. 5 little stars is all we need. And if you could write something nice in your comments, that would be greatly appreciated too. It helps our podcast to grow. So again, I want to thank Pat Fallon for being our guest this week. And I want to wish each and every one of you a safe and happy St. Patrick's Day as you celebrate. So celebrate sensibly this week. So till next week, stay well, get booked, and remember that when your work speaks for itself, don't interrupt. This is Scotty out. I tell you.